Welcome everyone to Academics Assemble, presented by the House of Wisdom podcast in collaboration with King's College London. I'm Deepak Mawar, an academic.
And I'm Anik Ahmed, someone who isn't an academic.
So I think we finally got somewhere with that, because I think throughout the whole season we've been trying to figure out what is your title, and a non-academic's perfect.
I think it is, and I probably don't want to say it too loud given we've got all academics on the panel and potentially many of the guests are in academia, but I think we found the right title for myself this season.
Finally, we can use something for next season onwards too. All right, so we might as well start getting into the talk and a little bit of an introduction on what we're doing and who we've got in line. So Anik, can you help us out with that?
So for anyone who is new to the House of Wisdom podcast, we launched at the start of this academic year. We've discussed topics ranging from modern slavery, obesity, climate change, big data, mental health, and much, much more. We love interviewing people who have the potential to make amazing contributions to the world around them, and we've found a really cool term to describe them, academic influencers. And so in this special episode, we bring together some of the leading minds from various fields to talk about the future of global cooperation. These guests continue to shape domestic and international policy on the most pressing matters. Before we start, though, we just wanted to say a big thank you to the Dixon Poon School of Law for hosting this event and being a big supporter of the podcast since we started. We really appreciate it. And to any of the guests, if you do have any questions, please share them on the chat and one of the moderators will pick it up for us to ask the guests at the end. We have a few questions that we want to ask some of the panelists as well. Deepak, who do we have on the panel today?
So we've got four really awesome guests with us today. We've been quite fortunate to have some of them on the podcast previously. So first of all, we've got Dr. Luke Abbs, who we interviewed about his work in nonviolent peaceful resistance. He is at the University of Winchester, researching in conflict and mediation. We've also got Dr. Nicole Vautrua back with us. So we talked to Nicole about her work on global health, global mental health, some of the stigma related around that and how that's affected policies in low and middle income countries. And she is also at King's College London in the psychology department. And we've got a bit of a newcomer with Dr. Nicola Palmer, who is a senior lecturer at King's College London, Dixon Poon School of Law. And she focuses in public international law, more specifically international criminal law and transitional justice. And then we've got back our very first guest. We're really quite excited to have our first guest back on for us, is Professor Andrzej Zwitter. We talked to him about big data and the impact that's happening on the world right now and where it's going to take us in the future. He's at the University of Groningen and he's the Dean of Faculty Campus Frisland. Guys, it's excellent to have you guys on. It's really fantastic. We're so excited to jump into the theme of this topic, and I suppose we'll get on with it now. So we are talking about global cooperation in this next hour to an hour and a half. And so in the last year, the United Nations celebrated its 75th anniversary. And to mark this milestone, they arranged a special event, The Future We Want, The Future We Need, reaffirming our collective commitment to multilateralism. It seems highly significant in the year that we've just had that the United Nations has placed a keen eye on states coming together to overcome global issues, especially when recent times the argument could be made that the latter is actually happening. So we could look at examples of India right now struggling with the COVID pandemic, the Myanmar struggles that we're definitely seeing this take place this past year. So for this reason, we wanted to discuss global cooperation with our panelists and to understand what this concept means for their research and for the disciplines they represent. So the first question we've got for our panelists is, what is global cooperation, multilateralism, and why is it important? To start it off, we're going to get Andre to give us a little bit of a take on global cooperation and this very important topic.
Thank you so much, Deepak. The concept of global cooperation is obviously one that is not entirely new. Traditionally, it was viewed as one that is predominantly amongst nation states, but we have slowly shifted away from that. And now with the emergence of new frameworks of theories of international relations, we are increasingly accounting also for international organizations internationally and nationally operating non-governmental organizations and corporations that make part of the fabric of international cooperation. And I think when you ask why is it important, then we really see right now with the global pandemic that these traditional bonds of international cooperation are being put to the test. And we see it with a new emergence of nationalism where concerns vaccines. So I think we are really at the break or make moment. And we see it specifically also with regards to support that needs to be lent in the future for the United Nations and similar international organizations when it comes to climate change, when it comes to conflicts, and when it comes to global health.
I think that's kind of key thing with global cooperation is such a wide-spanning topic, wide-spanning issue. And like you say, it touches upon various aspects, and one of them being conflict, which I suppose Luke can give us a little bit of an insight on in terms of how that idea of global cooperation has an impact on conflict and how intervention, how contributions can be really vital, can be really important.
Yeah, so I agree with Andre. So really it's some sort of kind of cross-country engagement in, you know, a shared goal or solution to problems that are regional or global. It can also be integration, so along political, economic, social, cultural lines. So for example, the EU would be an example of some form of global cooperation. In terms of conflict, I think in terms of, you know, insecurity, in terms of migration, you know, the consequence of conflict. I think in terms of climate change, and really these are issues that, you know, they cannot be solved by one country or one organization or one agency. For me, it's multi-agency, so multi-agency approach, including states, including different NGOs, including any other actors. So really it's about the sharing of expertise, sharing of ideas, sharing of kind of perspective. And I think what's really important is it's also linking, it's not just kind of global actors, it's also linking the local with the global, because global issues and local issues are often, you know, intertwined and cannot be separated from one another. So I think in terms of conflict and conflict research, there's been a real push in peace building away from these kind of top-down approaches, which is known as this kind of liberal peace, this kind of Western notion of what peace is, imposed in through kind of mediations and settlements that are kind of imposed from the top. And there's been this kind of what is known as the kind of local term in peace building to bring local actors into these processes. So I think on many different topics, whether that's peace building or climate change or health or many other topics, is really important to bring in these various different actors, as well as local and global actors.
I think that's a really important point in terms of we can't just look at global cooperation to be maybe just a state-centric idea. It has to actually incorporate a lot of different actors, be it state, non-states, corporations, NGOs, communities within a country, within the regions. I think that's really important. And I think that was something that Nicole was going to touch upon, especially with something like global mental health and mental health issues. The contribution that non-state actors plays is really integral, really quite important.
Yeah, that's right, Deepak. And I agree. I fully agree with everything that Andre and Luke just said. And we see that particularly in global health, everything that's been mentioned, and yeah, definitely also in mental health. I mean, we see that there's a collaboration of multiple actors and states to achieve common goals in global health and in global mental health. And we see that organizations such as WHO, the World Health Organization, the World Bank, the United Nations with the Sustainable Development Goals, they all have these cross-sectoral and really cross-dimensional approaches that touch on global, in order to achieve global health goals. We need to really think about other inequalities. So it may be peace building, conflict, poverty, climate that has been mentioned before, but even gender equality, all these things really influence and have an impact on the status of global health and global mental health. And the differences that we see and the inequalities in many regions, particularly north, south, and also east, west, and some kind of disbalances that we have, and the need for collaboration with the COVID-19 pandemic has, I think, been really pointed out again, how much it's important and how little we can really do as nation states and even those international actors, NGOs and other organizations, how helpless we can be if we just try to be acting on a national level, on a regional level. really need to think on the global whole and need to think about how the global influences the national and the regional and vice versa.
And although we've talked about non-state actors being quite important and playing an important role, states do still have that important role. And I suppose from an international law perspective, that's quite central. That's quite a centric idea, actually, in terms of states driving forward certain initiatives to reach some sort of a conclusion, some sort of resolution for global issues, global problems. Nicola, maybe perhaps you could give us a little bit of an insight in terms of public international law. What's the feeling about global cooperation? Why is it important? Why is it such a necessity for achieving some of the most important goals that we have?
Thanks, Deepak. So I think in public international law, we sort of we start to see how global one of the routes through which global cooperation can be realized. And that's through a series of agreed rules that are being established between states. And so, you know, these can be explicitly established through treaty or through state practice or through general principles and legal writings. And it's this that has really offered some of the procedural basis to then develop the international institutions that we're now all very familiar with, such as the United Nations. And in terms of my work, the International Criminal Court. And these institutions then shape that global cooperation as well. But I mean, building on the earlier discussion, what we're seeing in public international law as well is this increasing focus on lawmaking that's including a wider set of actors. And so this, you know, that local activists, specific state representatives, corporate actors, international NGOs, they themselves are shaping the development of international law and the relationship between international law and national and local lawmaking. So, I've recently been reading Greg Schaffer and Terry Halliday's work on transnational legal orders, and they're really arguing that in the future of public international law, we need really to be placing states in this wider ecology of national and global lawmaking. And in terms of my own work, I think this then asks us to start to recognize the intimacy between the historical ways through which global cooperation has operated and how this has mapped onto and been quite Eurocentric and has mapped onto the colonial project, and how this connects with sort of with current global inequalities that we're facing today. So in my work in transnational criminal law, I'm interested in looking at the coordinates of criminal law globally. And so we can start to see where substantively, geographically, and materially, where this cooperation is happening.
So I find a real linkage between Luke's work and Nicola's work. And I think that does tap onto that a little bit in terms of moving beyond that kind of top-down approach, you know, starting from the top and then trying to provide some sort of support. Luke, you did a lot of interesting research in terms of actually having successful peace processes take place. And you talked about how kind of the more community aspect can be a really important influence. So rather than, I suppose, taking that top-down approach where the UN will come in and intervene, we're actually maybe perhaps providing more support for these kind of communities to make some sort of improvements to actually come to find some sort of peaceful process. Luke, what's your kind of take on that?
A lot of kind of peace processes have been too top down. And one of the things that I've noticed with some of the research I've been conducting is there is a role for nonviolent actors on the ground, and whether this is forms of resistance or engagement work or peace building work, you know, variety of different roles. Actors tend to lose influence as time goes on, or we suspect this may be the case. So, you know, we're finding a lot of good research that nonviolent actors are really good in fostering the initiation of a peace process, so initial negotiations. But when it comes to formal negotiations, they're largely excluded. You know, most cases, most formal negotiations, civil society actors are basically excluded. And it's a real shame, because when they are included, we're seeing much better outcomes, like more durable peace, you know, democratization. So factors which reduce the likelihood of the conflict turning violent again at a later point. So it is a real shame. But just feeding into, you know, some of what Nicole has said as well, you know, this what's really key is inclusion. So inclusion of different kind of global actors, but also inclusion of different local actors. So inclusion of, you know, along gender lines. You know, women's organisations have been really crucial in peace building. There's many examples. For example, Women of Liberia Mass Action for Peace, a group of women that came together from different ethnic groups, different religious groups, came across kind of conflict lines. They came together and basically demanded for peace and were very successful in doing that. And their legacy was the first, the first female president in Africa. So, this continues to have a good legacy in Liberia. So that's just one example, and also including religious actors, because, we come from very secular backgrounds, in the countries that we've grown up in, and religion plays quite a crucial role in different parts of the world. So bringing in religious actors, but understanding how this varies across different contexts is really important. So yeah, it's not just about global actors, but local actors, and also, what different global actors will bring different factors to a peace process, different expertise, different perspectives. And basically where there's a peace process where different kind of actors are included and providing different technical support, these are there's evidence that they're a bit more successful as well. So cooperation is really super important.
Great answers from all our panelists. And just quickly before we move on to our next question, I know we said we would leave Q&A to the end, but I just got a burning question. I'll ask Deepak first, actually, because he's also doing a lot of relevant research in this area. Do you think there's limitations to our definition of global cooperation and a disconnect kind of between our ambitions and what we want to achieve and what reality allows us to achieve? I'm thinking in the context of, we spend a lot of time talking to an array of academics for our podcast season, talking about international law and economic incentives in particularly. And it just strikes me that we have this kind of utopian view of what we want to achieve, and why can't we just go enter countries and save all these people that are migrating or having issues? But obviously that's not the reality. I'm great to hear your view, Deepak, considering you've got a book on this. Before we ask the guests.
So I think my feeling on it is that, and I think it links up with what a lot of the guests are saying, and particularly in what Luke is saying, I think our perception of what global cooperation is and isn't perhaps truly global. And that's perhaps one of our problems and one of the hindrances that we're having. So we're not including non-state actors in that conversation. So we're having peace processes take place. Are we including communities to actually be part of that process? And I think it's part of that. I think that's one of the issues, perhaps, why we're facing this issue. We are trying to tackle global problems, but perhaps the avenue through which we're trying to tackle it is not the best process that we've got. So I think when we think about global cooperation, we talk about global cooperation, we should think about it as it being global, not just state-centric, but actually including those various actors to be part of that process. And perhaps that might be a better way of achieving those goals, achieving those aims. Anyone else want to add into that? Andre, go for it.
No, I think the interesting combination that comes here together is indeed the crux between how do we regulate ourselves on an international level? And we have a model for that, right? That's the Westphalian model, with states as being the only subjects of international law on the one hand. And on the other hand, we have an international legal system that is very, very Western and requires quite some decolonialization, specifically when we look, for example, at the framework of human rights. Human rights are in themselves a very good example, because they depart from the assumption of a state that ensures those rights, and at the same time, specific individual rights that can be claimed vis-a-vis states. But this notion of individual rights against the state is a very Western concept. And we saw with, for example, the African Charter of Human Rights, that group rights became much more important than we initially thought. And bringing it also a bit to the technology side, where my expertise lies, right now we have this conundrum where privacy norms are specifically tailored towards individual, towards the protection of the individual. Whereas we notice that aggregate data can be a threat to groups, specifically, for example, when it comes to peace processes, where political groups in and of themselves can be very vulnerable, and insights into their behavior through the use of, say, cell phone location data can be very threatening to them. And so suddenly, in the Western concept, group rights, such as group privacy, is also emerging. And so I think there is really some changes going on that we need to take very serious.
Nicole, did you want to add something?
Yeah, to both of what Andre said and you, Deepak, I mean, I think it is clear, or has been clear for a long time, that we're moving away from that state concept, right? Much more towards the power or gaining power and increasing power of multinational organizations such as Amazon or Microsoft or whatever we see. And now I think that, again, with COVID-19, it's such a good example of how much we, one, on the one hand, rely on organizations such as Zoom or Microsoft, but on the other hand, how they also have a massive impact on our global, on our health systems, and how people are essentially exposed to risks of exploitation and all these inequalities that come with it. So, I mean, talking about, for instance, people who work for Amazon delivery services or Deliveroo or, you know, all these organizations, Uber, how do we regulate that and how much impact that has on health overall and individually, and how many cross links there exist. And I mean another issue that really highlights the inequalities is of course the vaccine discussion that we have around COVID-19 now. And while in the beginning when you started, Deepak, about okay, are we aiming for something that we can't achieve and should we even do this? And I think yes, we should. We should believe that there is something that we can believe in and that we can do better, because we always should strive to sort of improve as a whole, an entire global society. But the question is, do we want equality? I think, I mean, even in health, it is, are we willing to accept that equality means that we might not be able to receive our, I don't know, packages? You know, there's a lot of trade-offs that we would have to agree on, and not just individually, but also as nations, Western nations towards perhaps the South, the global South, regions. And yeah, talking about the migrant crisis, it's a global crisis, right? It's about inequalities. And so yeah, there's a lot to do.
Do any of the other panelists have any thoughts? Nicola?
What I wanted to talk about was that in looking at the sort of wider ecology of actors in global cooperation, I think it's also really exciting to start to look at the sites of resistance to that. And some of those are sort of traditional sites of resistance. And I think we see that, to build on Nicole's point, I think we see that today with the US pushing for agreements on a universal taxing, a corporation tax, and that This is a very interesting point where a traditional actor, a state, is starting to take on the corporations through global cooperation, through states starting to agree on a 15% basic corporate tax threshold. And I think this is quite an exciting initiative. I then think that this wider ecology opens up some really interesting other examples. So going back to the Amazon point that Nicole raised, in South Africa in the last 3 weeks, we've seen a really interesting push against Amazon's bid to try to create its African headquarters on a wetland in Cape Town. And so there has been litigation from a Khoisan community group based on claims to the heritage and the historical significance of that particular site in opposition to a global conglomerate. So, you know, I think we need to, I think that's where we start to see some of the real vibrance of global cooperation in this wider ecology.
Luke, do you want to add anything?
I think one of the biggest challenges to our notion of global cooperation is, you know, is this power imbalance. So one of the most frustrating things about interventions, like peace interventions or dealing with insecurity or anywhere in the world, is it really is unequal. So, I mean, we're all aware of the UN system, you know, the 5 permanent members, and, you know, how they can veto any kind of security resolution. And this happens constantly. So really what we're having is this imbalance of, you know, conflicts such as Syria. There's not really much that can be done about it because of that imbalance in the international system. And obviously it's really frustrating because Syria is, you know, it is an awful case, but also it's leading to huge amounts of migration. You know, we're up to nearly 7 million refugees, mostly in countries that neighbor Syria. You have Lebanon, which is, you know, a large, a very significant proportion of their population is Syrian refugees. And this is a country that simply cannot handle that number of refugees. So you're having all sorts of problems, but you can't really do much about it. Whereas in other contexts, for example, the Central African Republic, where there's less kind of international interest, less reason to veto any intervention there, you have all of the different organizations based there. And there's no other country on earth that's had more peacekeeping missions than the Central African Republic. So it's getting all of the support and all of the help, which kind of comes with its own problems, but, you know, at least they're trying to deal with the problems there and the issues in the country. So you really have this imbalance. So this notion of pushing back against corporations, you know, is really important, because this is playing a role, but also pushing back at these power imbalances, because they're really preventing cooperation in key areas and in certain contexts where it's needed. You know, it's a real shame what is happening in Syria. And when I went to university, I often thought, you know, how did Bosnia happen? You know, why was that allowed to happen? And, you know, the peacekeeping mission is difficult because there was no peace to keep. And the way that peacekeeping has evolved since then, the way that peacekeeping operations are structured and the mandates that come with them are totally different. But, you know, why was that allowed to happen? And then we have the same situation in Syria where, you know, there's not really, it really is up to certain countries like Russia or Turkey that are playing a crucial role and have troops on the ground. It's really up to them to try and find a solution. And everyone else has kind of been pushed out. And the role of all of the actors that we've been talking about, local actors, I mean, it's completely, but there's no political space for that. So it's these political imbalances and these inequalities are continue to be an issue.
I think we're gonna try and solve that in the Q&A later. I've got a little idea how we can solve those issues, Luke. But no, fascinating insights from all of you. So thank you. On to the next question, which some of you have touched upon, but let's get it out there. So in a post-COVID world, do you see states cooperating less? Nicola, be great to hear your views on this.
In the post-COVID world, I think cooperation will clearly continue, but I think we need to be conscious of the different forms that cooperation is taking. So some of those forms, as we've been talking about, are quite productive. So I think the South African and Indian cooperation in relation to pushing for the intellectual patent waivers and the recent US support for that in terms of potentially enabling and enhancing the access that states will have to producing the vaccine in particular, I think that's really productive. But I think there are other areas where that cooperation is deeply concerning. So I think we see this most readily at the moment in relation to cooperation that is underpinned by an anti-immigrant sentiment. And so here, I think, you know, we've seen the European Union's, and, you know, since between the years of 2014 and 2019, expelling 2.6 million people outside of the European Union on the base. And so the sort of fortress Europe, and as a form of securing European solidarity on these ideas of repression and exclusion, rather than on more liberating sets of norms, I think is the type of cooperation that we should be concerned about and pushing back against. So I think that the potential is there for very constructive cooperation and for other types of cooperation that we should be actively critiquing.
Yeah, I felt the anti-immigration sentiment has really had a huge impact on the political spectrum in the last 5 or 7 years. And I think that has actually drawn us further away from global cooperation than ever. You know, a good example of that could be, you know, Brexit is a good example of that. Moving on to perhaps Luke, could you give us a little bit of a take on it in terms of, you know, are states going to be contributing a little bit less? Are they going to start cooperating less, considering that they've got more issues now on a national level? Is that going to be then that prioritisation that's going to most likely take place?
Yeah, I mean, I'm also quite sceptical about cooperation in the future, now and in the future. So in terms of, you know, the migration crisis has never been as bad as it is now. I mean, there's 80 million people on the move. There's 46 million people that are refugees. And so 46 million people that are internally displaced within their countries. And there's 26 million refugees. So this is record numbers. And what's really concerning about that is armed conflict has actually reduced somewhat. So there's a whole debate in conflict literature on whether violence has reduced over time. And we have seen a reduction from the 90s, where there was a lot of really bad civil wars and a lot of violence, a lot of people killed. We are seeing a reduction in violence. We're seeing less civil wars. Obviously, there's still lots. And Syria is a very bad civil war, which kind of trumps some of them figures. But we're seeing this decline in violence, yet we're seeing this increase in the number of people on the move. So you've got economic factors, you've got climate change, which is increasingly playing a role. These are all really big, important global issues that I really just don't feel like we're capable at the moment of dealing with. And linking it back to, you know, the pandemic and how we've dealt with it, there's been lots of good cooperation in terms of, you know, how do you develop a vaccine? You know, you're using expertise from scientists all over the world. Then you're using different parts of the world who have capacity to actually produce the vaccine, and then you're sending it to different parts of the world. So there's lots of good and others will know much more about that than I do, because I don't have expertise in health, but there's lots of cooperation there. However, we're getting nationalism in terms of vaccine, who gets it and who doesn't, which is incredible. So you have a situation where India is suffering really badly with this second wave. And they can't get access to vaccines yet. People in this country are worrying about whether they're going to go on holiday this summer. And, you know, we're going to hopefully have second doses in this country, at least, you know, definitely by the end of the year, if not, you know, sometime early in autumn. So we have this kind of nationalism that's developed. So who gets what and who gets it first? And it seems to be this with migration. So we're just passing the buck. You know, who has to deal with it? Italy, Spain, Greece, the frontier nations in Europe really are having to deal with it, or sending migrants to Libya, which is a war-torn country and totally incapable of dealing with these number of migrants, or just leaving it to countries like Lebanon, which are having huge issues, like economically, socially, the instability in these countries. And we all know what happened in Beirut last year. It just really sums up the situation there. So I really just think there's this nationalism going on, and then passing the buck. We're not really solving this issue. So I'm a lot more skeptical. And just to add to this, I don't want to speak too long, but I'm skeptical about, you know, how we're dealing with instability. We're seeing a lot of funding cuts which are occurring. So the UK is not reaching its obligation to use, you know, 0.7% of its GDP to pump into kind of foreign aid. This is having huge ramifications on different parts of the world. And the UK has funded very good projects, like, for example, in Yemen, you know, which is really keeping people alive, or development projects that's trying to solve the crisis there, you know, which would keep the migration that's occurring in these countries and in the source. You have to solve the source of the problem, not let it kind of fester and then try and pass the buck when it gets out of hand. So, and Guterres, the UN General Secretary, has basically said what's happening in Yemen is it's a complete catastrophe. They've only been able to gain 50% of the aid that they need for the country, while the UK is cutting its aid budget, which is really crucial, you know, in contexts like Somalia, South Sudan, which is one of the biggest contributors of refugees. So yeah, I'm kind of rather skeptical. And then lastly, this merging of DFID, the development ministry, merging that with the FCO, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office in the UK, you're linking development issues with diplomatic issues. So are we going to be conditioning that aid now to, you know, to countries which serve our purpose or you know, have a more diplomatic benefit? So I'm really concerned, and I'll stop there.
It seems like a common theme seems to be short-term thinking. The idea of we're just thinking about the step before us rather than maybe the next 5 to 10 steps. And a perfect example of that is with the COVID vaccine, the kind of isolationist strategy. We're just thinking about just vaccinating our countries. Well, we're not thinking about, well, developing countries, if they're not getting vaccinated, there may be a new variant that might crop up, and that's going to then start infecting the whole world, and we're back to square one again. So I think that is definitely a key issue, and this idea perhaps of the danger of new nationalism, which I think Andre wanted to touch upon. So I'm going to let Andre perhaps link in with that, and this idea of why this idea of new nationalism is such a dangerous feature.
Indeed. I mean, we see in every crisis that is large enough that that you have two effects, right? You have the empathic movement where we vibrate and resonate with people in need. And at the same time, when it comes to close to ourselves, and specifically we saw it also with this pandemic, then the me first attitude pops in. And when you translate that into theoretical terms, right, the concept of Kant's liberal peace, in Kant's conception, if we just have the right norms, and if we keep on trade amongst nations, amongst separate federal states, and as long as we're just honest with each other, so to speak, on a state level, it will be fine, right? And we've seen over and over again that this is not enough. And if you look at other authors such as Reinhold Niebuhr, with his famous book Moral Man, Immoral Society, he tried to show how difficult it is to translate empathy and moral sentiment from an individual small group level to a national or even a global level. And this is where we see opportunism emerging on a larger, on a nation state level, specifically when it comes to the end of the COVID crisis. So when you look at the way that countries such as China have made sure that as soon as they came out of the crisis, they pushed ahead economically, such as with the Belt and Road Initiative, in order to gain an advantage vis-a-vis other states and thereby dominate also the global landscape. This can only reinforce a pushback, what we call in international relations, a move towards a balance of power, where other countries try to counterbalance such pushes for power dominance. And so this will, Nicola is very right when she said, you know, we don't only have to look at whether there will be global cooperation or will there be not global cooperation. We also need to look at what is the nature of that cooperation, right? Will it be benign, and will it be for the right purpose, such as fixing climate change? Or will it be trying to cut down power of some emergent new superpower? You know, and so this will very much, the nature of this global cooperation will very much determine whether we are entering a new stage of a Cold War, or whether we can actually emerge into a better society. And I see Nicole has to add something there.
Yeah, no, you, thanks, Andre. You touched on something that came to my mind before, and I thought, should I say it or not? But it's exactly that. I mean, I did also think of, it's not just nationalism that we're facing, actually, right? Because we're not, when we talk about multilateral collaboration or multilateralism or global cooperation, it seems a bit, we're academics talking about how the world and states and organizations should collaborate or whatever, but actually it's all people in these states, in these countries, and these nationalisms are actually, in addition, I think, driven by this increasing radicalization and extremization of views, and potentially also been driven by fear of unemployment, but then also these health risks. We see that in Europe. And so when I grew up, I remember when, I don't know, I would have never imagined before moving to the UK that ever the UK would be leaving the European Union. And yet it happened, and really quickly. And there's a risk that we have. And in terms of what you just said about that Cold War, I think in Europe we're really conscious of what it means, or maybe our age group, of growing up with parents and grandparents who have experienced the Cold War and the Iron Curtain, and what it means if your brothers and dads have to go to war or have been in war, and all the trauma and mental health impact and health impact on societies that brings, and of course on economic wealth and all that, and stability. So I'm really concerned, because it seems like a very, very fragile point where we are if we don't also and we, when I say we, probably I mean policymakers, and I mean academics and the media and society as a whole, take that serious, and also that responsibility that we have in taking forward that 70-year-long peace that we've had, we've been so fortunate to have in Europe. And essentially, rather than limiting ourselves to more extremism, seeing how we can improve on and increase and become that better society in other areas of the world, and supporting people there and not telling them how to do it, but essentially changing our view on inequalities and all that. And yeah, having a more long, not this short-sighted, what you said in the beginning, Deepak, about this short-sighted approach to collaboration. It's really not that, right? We cannot fix these issues in 2 years, and we cannot fix them in 10 years probably. So it's something that goes beyond legislative periods, and it needs to address these points of, yeah, fake news or fears that people have who are maybe not able to access information as we as academics, for instance, might, or as policymakers might, and how we can translate this better to society.
So I'm going to be a bit of a martyr to sharpen your pitchforks and stab away for this we'll see if it's a controversial question, but all of you, and I'd include myself, we're kind of alluding to this idea that the system that we've got in place that puts states at the front and center seems to not really work for this idea of global cooperation, or the kind of global cooperation we'd like to see. So on that basis, I mean, you're all saying we're moving beyond that. So do states really matter? Do we need to put any focus on states? Should we just, you know, ignore them and start thinking about multilateral corporations or regional organizations and NGOs? Should we just not bother with the states anymore and just kind of get on with it? Who wants to start off with start this off? Luke.
I mean, the fact is states matter, whatever way you look around it. I mean, maybe they matter a little less than they did before. And as we continue through the decades, maybe they matter less and less. But at the moment, they do matter. And one of the, just bringing together everything that everyone said, really, the one thing that we're consistently seeing is that states or governments that are running these states are continuously being reactive rather than proactive. And we've seen that in the pandemic, you know, obviously it started in China, and then we saw what happened in Italy. And then, I can only say for what happened in the UK, but it was just like, okay, that's not going to happen here. You know, people just didn't, I mean, obviously the people that knew it was coming, but most people just, you know, that's not us, it's not going to happen. And then we kind of, you know, we've seen the same again and again and again. So it's this kind of short-term thinking. You know, we're going to be reactive rather than proactive. And I think what the reason is because there's political incentives to be reactive rather than proactive, because many of the solutions that we need need preventative measures. And the problem with prevention is, how do we know we've prevented something? You know, it always looks like an overreaction. So it's the same with the response to the pandemic. Like, should we lock down now? And obviously the lockdowns were the last resort. That's the last thing we had. Should we lock down now, or should we leave it? But if you lock down too early, then, you know, maybe that wave wasn't coming. So, you know, this is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with political incentives to be reactive rather than proactive. So in that sense, states do really matter. Politics within these states really does matter. And this reduces that ability to cooperate. So the same with climate change. We're moving that way, and there is a push, right? But we can prevent it still. We're still being way too slow and moving way too slow, because the incentives are still to carry on with the status quo, to be more reactive rather than proactive. So it's incredibly frustrating. And bringing it to my area of research, you know, there's this whole notion of conflict prevention, which obviously makes more sense. You don't want there to be a civil war. You want to prevent a civil war, because it's so much less costly. You know, this is why prevention's good. It's so much less costly than letting things play out and then trying to react. You know, so it's really challenging. So you had a UN mission in Macedonia, which is the only kind of prevention mission that I can think of, where peacekeepers were sent. There was conflict in Bosnia and other neighboring nations. In Macedonia, there was tensions between Macedonians and Albanians in the country. So they sent a mission there early. They did lots of good offices and mediation between the different between the political actors. They did lots of kind of workshops with, you know, people on the ground, you know, trying to get the society angle of this. And there was no conflict. And then essentially, I think Macedonia made the mistake of trading with Taiwan, which obviously really annoyed China because of their one China policy. And China pulled the plug on the mission. 1 month later, you had a civil war. But, you know, did it prevent that civil war? Was that civil war going to happen anyway? I would argue it would have prevented the civil war. You know, but once again, states were important. Pulling that peacekeeping mission, I would argue, led to that civil war. You know, but prevention, that was the way forward. So I understand that's probably quite provocative, but I think prevention is the way forward, but it's politically costly, unfortunately.
Nicola, as the international, I feel like you'll be able to effectively destroy my stateless dream. So go for it.
Well, Deepak, just, you know, be careful. There are a whole range of different types of international lawyer. And you can't have this many academics talking to each other without some level of disagreement. So, Andre, I think my point of disagreement comes up here with your idea that there's benign cooperation. I don't think there's ever been benign cooperation. I think that there have always been winners and losers when states start to cooperate or when another, you know, we could still say a wider range of actors start to cooperate. So I've recently, this goes to the international lawyer question, Deepak, I've recently been reading Mahmud Mamdani's Neither Settler Nor Native, which he goes back to Westphalia to start to say that that agreement, the Westphalian treaty, was absolutely informed by the shared experience of European colonialism. And so that in that moment of cooperation that international lawyers use as this grounding point in creating this international system, it was being created it was co-constituted by European colonialism. Now, I think that these are the types of arguments that we need to be taking very seriously. I think we need this longer critical historical engagement with with the terms on which we have built global cooperation up to now, in order to be able to more effectively be more honest with ourselves about what's at stake with the global cooperation going forward. Because global cooperation going forward, in my view, has to find a way of cooperating over shared public goods that cannot be solely determined on private ownership, because we share a single globe. And I think that's where the great potential comes, but I also think that is where the great challenge comes, because states are key, but we need to be taking very seriously the role that states can play in challenging private property rather than only reinforcing it.
I feel like that's perfectly set up for Andre to have a counter discussion.
Nicole, wonderful. I loved it. No benign cooperation. Well, I think there is probably something to it, and specifically when states come together to cooperate, there's always some trade-offs happening. Doesn't mean that the outcome can't be benign, right? If we look at all operational agencies of the United Nations, so those agencies that have as a governing body state representatives, right? We're speaking of the World Food Programme, we're speaking of UNICEF, of WFP, and so forth. These organizations do really do their utmost to alleviate suffering, right? And that is true for most developmental and humanitarian agencies, particularly also those that have state representation. So I think there is some sort of a goodwill, and it reminds me very much of the story of how one of the oldest, well, if not the oldest UN agency came to be, namely UNICEF. Right, the way that UNICEF was created was at the very early days of Cold War politics, just right at the end of Second World War. Politicians of the Allied states were sitting together discussing what to do with the leftover dried milk and blankets that were essentially still floating around. And these negotiations went on for days because they couldn't agree who will get it. And until Ludwig Reichmann, a Polish diplomat, stood up and I'm paraphrasing him here, but he essentially said, well, you all shut up now, because if you can't agree who the dried milk and the blankets go to, give it to me and I'll do something for the children. And the Allied state said, wonderful, you do something for the Allied children. And he said, no, if I do something, I'll do it without interference for all the children, right? And I think that goes to show how individual virtue can sometimes trump state politics. It's very rare, doesn't happen very often, but I think it's one of those beautiful stories that is so inspiring, because I think this is what we are needing right now. We need moral leadership that is really showing a little bit the way forward where we as a globe need to go, because I'm not seeing right now how we are getting out of the global crisis, plural, that we are facing, right? Climate change, poverty, migration, global conflicts, and of course, a ongoing pandemic. And then don't even count all the asteroids that are threatening to hit us and so forth. I mean, we are literally at this brink of where we are going to into great demise, and we are not getting it apparently on a global level. So I think, yes, we need a global moral leadership here again.
Nicole, your turn.
Yeah, no, I agree with what you say, Andre, and also what's been said before, Nicola, and all. But I mean, the thing is, I mean, for instance, the mental health crisis, right, is another really global leading crisis that we're ignoring, and that has a massive impact, and we're completely short-sighted in how we're dealing with it as in terms of global cooperation. And Luke mentioned earlier, there's 80 million people on the move right now. I mean, 80 million people homeless somewhere across the globe. Where are these people sleeping? What are they eating? How do they keep in touch with their friends? How is their mental health being impacted, their physical health impacted, while they are on somewhere in between mountains and the sea and being chased by other people and I don't know what? I mean, horrific situation. 80 million people. Who is protecting these people? And that is while I agree fully, there is this shift towards an opening and this, I mean, it has been said a couple of times that we need to kind of push back on global corporations or international corporations, but I think it's perhaps finding a way to hold them accountable and to integrate them within the system of national states and understanding also the potential of national states and the responsibility in protecting individuals. So for instance, Hannah Arendt, she has pointed out, a political philosopher who experienced the Nazi regime, she has pointed out the critical issue of homeless and stateless people. I mean, these 80 million people have children that are born somewhere in between the mountains and the sea. Where do they belong to? Who is going to take healthcare for them? Who is going to treat any kind of issues or give them a job? Who's educating them? And the impact that all of this has on all countries in the world, and that we're essentially all responsible and also impacted by that. So I don't know, we need a longer term view and I don't know how to solve that issue. I mean, Nicola mentioned earlier that there's this lots of an increasing international law or increasingly more international law being made. And I think a key challenge is probably to find a way to hold organizations accountable and to get them to contribute to the overall burden and responsibility.
One of the reasons I really asked that question was to actually just highlight states are still important. I suppose we spent the first part of it talking about how non-state actors are such a key part of it all. I think it's quite easy for us to then think, well, let's forget about the states and let's just focus on what these non-state actors are doing. And also maybe even thinking that the state is the problem, that we need to actually think about moving beyond the state. So I think it's very important that we appreciate we're talking about global cooperation. So that has to be all parts of the globe, all parts of the global community that we're looking at. And just a little add-on to Nicola's little anecdote about Westphalia. and states coming together and that shared experience. It was the same thing with the League of Nations. It was the same thing with the United Nations. That shared experience of going through or experiencing the wars really did allow for international law to advance, allow for these international organizations to advance, to really look at and focus on aspects of peace and security. So it is very important that we think about the state as being part of that solution, not being actually the problem to it. So now we're going to move on to the last question. Nicola, did you want to add something else quickly?
I just wanted to build on that for a second, because I think one of the really positive aspects of the pandemic has been increase in state spending. So we've had, I mean, in the UK, we've had austerity for a very long time, and I really have some concerns about the future reintroduction of austerity. But I think we're seeing under the Biden administration a resurgence in the role that the state can play in providing social protection. And I think there's a huge opportunity here for the state to start to rebalance global inequality. So Deepak, I agree with you entirely that that the state, that we need to look at the liberating potential of the state rather than only looking at its constraining possibilities as well.
I'll add my two pence as a non-academic in the world quickly before I move on. But I can imagine a world where we will go to the polls and it will be a choice between Google and Amazon. And those will be the two parties that we'll be electing at some point. So I'll finish that theme on that thought for everyone. You can tell I read a lot of dystopian fiction, so that's where that's come from. So, yes, with so many sources for supposed facts and objective analysis, it's never been as important as it has been today to find reliable truths. In this new era of fake news, we believe academics have a powerful role to play through wider discourse with the public. Opening this theme to the guests then, why is it important academics communicate their ideas in an accessible manner to the wider public? And it would be great if Nicole kicks us off on that.
It's essentially, we have, as I said before, we have a role as members of our society, of our global society, but also as individuals and as academics, I believe, to engage in that process of making our knowledge and our findings available. And I mean, as we're discussing it now, we are always risking to separate us from the people that are actually affected or concerned by everything that we're discussing as academics. So there's really a need to engage in a global process and in a regional and local process of involving all stakeholders in that process. So we have academics, we have research clouds or research, that's based on my own research now based on mental health or global mental health, but I think it's transferable to more or less global health and potentially even global cooperation. We have all these inactive state enactors, people who are implementing policies, who are implementing findings from research and academia, such as medical doctors in the field, for instance, when we talk about the medical field. And they have their own findings. So it's really essential to be working really closely as academics with them and together with policymakers and policymakers on a regional and local level who are in the field, who see the local changes, but also those on a national level. And then, as we said earlier, on a global or international level. So WHO, the UN, and people who are really, and organizations, multilateral organizations, and international organizations such as Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, for instance, in health, they are doing a lot, they're influencing a lot, and they are taking things forward a lot. And with that, and by engaging, constantly engaging, and finding a way to both build capacity within all of those areas and all of those stakeholders to engage in the process and to communicate that, and to maintain that constant engagement and relationship, and then address issues as they come up, and not just as I, for instance, academic, think is relevant, but essentially a conversation more or less as we're having it now, right now, the six of us and bringing that together and seeing, okay, right, these are issues that are not just affecting people in mental health, these are actually legal issues, these are issues that we need in conflict, I mean, the main issues, and what can we do on a state level, how can we take things forward, and in particular, I think it's very important to address these issues of, And I mean, my field is global health and global mental health, but really inequality, I think, is such an important point to address. And there's, for instance, this philosopher, John Rawls, who had this idea, or had a good suggestion for how we can think of what we could or should do as individuals, but also perhaps as nations, in thinking about global cooperation. And he had this idea of the veil of ignorance. So essentially what it means is, if I don't know what is fair and what is equal and what would be a good decision to make, I just imagine I'm in a situation where I don't know. So for instance, we're all born, I'm born in Europe. Some people are born in Ethiopia and I don't know, in other countries, some people are born in poverty without parents. I mean, essentially, we probably didn't choose it. At least we don't remember it. And so we don't know. And then if we imagine the situation where all of us don't know how and where we are born. Will I have HIV? Will I be affected of a mental health problem? Will I be living in poverty? And then considering, okay, having that risk of, okay, I might as well be someone who is not in a good position, who is not fortunate enough to live in a warm house in the UK and have the ability to go on holiday even during a pandemic. So what would I do? And from that, based on that, with that veil of ignorance, I think we can take decisions, or we could influence decisions that are more fair and more equal towards people who are not in a fortunate position as we are.
Luke, we have talked long into the night about science communication, about us academics getting out there. So perhaps maybe you could give us a little bit of an insight on that.
Yeah, it's a very good question. And it's challenging, you know. So I think on one hand, I think, you know, as Nicole was saying, I do think academia has a lot to offer. And so I can only really draw on some experiences I've had in terms of data science. So a lot of the work I do use is kind of data analytics. And my last role at the University of Essex was working with local governments, police forces, as well as doing my own academic research on conflict. And, you know, there is a gap there. There's a gap in ability to do data analysis. And, you know, so many skills we have, and it's just one example, right? There's so many skills we have in academia, data analysis or quantitative analysis, machine learning. You know, these are all skills that we have in academia, which are really useful for the real world. And the fact that, you know, 90% of the data we've ever produced has happened in the last 2 years or so. You know, we have all this new data and this opportunity to do data analysis, to use it to respond to health, to respond to conflict, to respond to crime. You know, so there's an opportunity there. So what the point I'm trying to make is that there's skills in academia that can be really useful for policy. But I think there has to be a bit more of a fusion in that much of the time we're looking at, you know, what is the gap in our knowledge? What is the gap in what we know, what we don't know? And what's a really interesting research question to go away and look at? And most of the time we're looking at, you know, stuff that's interesting to ourselves. But I think some of the questions need to come from policy. So what does policy need to know? And then go away and actually explore this, you know. So I've done some research on UN peacekeeping, but what's really useful for UN peacekeeping? What's really useful for United Nations Operation Crisis Center? You know, is prediction, trying to predict where the next conflict event occurs, is that more useful for them? How can we contribute to that? How can we help? How could we use data analysis and machine learning to get to that endpoint? You know, so we're and there is this fusion going on, but it's difficult, right? Especially in data, the issue of data sharing is an absolute nightmare. And others on the panel might have experiences with this. So it's difficult. We have to bridge the gap because that we have expertise as well. We have skills that are very useful. And I think maybe it's a bit controversial to say, but I think we have less of an agenda. You know, our agenda is to do good. My agenda is to reduce violence, armed violence. I hate the fact that civilians on the other side of the world experience violence. They shouldn't have to. You know, that's the goal, obviously. So obviously I have an agenda, but our agenda is not impacted by politics. you know, the agenda, like during this crisis, the political agenda is really undermined how we're tackling COVID time and time again. At the end of the day, we should be here to save lives. And, you know, like we have this false dichotomy of balancing lives with the economy. It's absolute nonsense. And it has been from the beginning. From a statistical point of view, from exponential growth, you know, like it doesn't make sense. The longer you wait, the longer we are in lockdowns. It's as simple as that. But, you know, there's politics involved with that. So it's really, really challenging and frustrating. The scientists who have dealt with this COVID crisis have nothing but admiration for what they've done. And I think just to link that back in, we have that challenge of how do we get our ideas out there? Because we are battling against misinformation. We're battling against narratives which are wrong and sometimes very distasteful. Like how do we push back against that? I will stop there because I've raised a number of issues.
One concern I've always had about the world of academia is perhaps we do stay in our bubble a little bit too much. I mean, maybe we don't engage enough with the outside public and the outside world that's beyond, you know, the university and the ivory tower. And I think that does, you know, put a disservice of what we can provide, what kind of role we can play within society. Nicola, perhaps maybe you could add a little bit to that. Maybe are we too stuck in our little community? Do we need to branch out? Do we need to engage a little bit more outside of the world of academia, outside the university environment?
I mean, I think the engagement outside the university environment is one of the best bits about being an academic. So I think we see academics at the moment being an integral part of the global news cycle. So, you know, you can't watch a news bulletin without academics both having the opportunity to and being invited to start to comment on these events. And I think this is actually a relatively recent development, and I think it's an incredibly powerful one. And I think then as academics, one of the challenges we have is when you've been working on a question and thinking about it for 5 years, how do you communicate it in 30 seconds? And how do you, and so that the develop, that's a skill, I think, as academics, we should be focused on trying to improve. And a lot of that is practice. So, and taking seriously the expertise of journalists as well. So that, you know, there is mutual learning that can happen here. So I think that's exciting. I think building on Luke's point, I think there's real potential for, and certainly in terms of my own work, I've cooperated extensively with the third sector, with NGOs. So I've worked with Swiss Peace, and we developed a transitional justice methods manual that was really trying to look at some of the more innovative methods of understanding how responses to mass violence are designed, implemented, and assessed, and packaging them in a way that might actually be useful in an NGO context that's accessible, short, and free. So, you know, one of the big challenges in academia is we should all be pushing for open access. There is absolutely no reason that we should be propping up publishing industries when really we're public institutions that are producing public knowledge. And so I think these are the fights we should be having. I think the potential of it is huge, and it's growing, because ideas do matter, and universities are an amazing space to cultivate those ideas and then really practice how we communicate out. And I think, you know, Ahmed, and you are really leading on this in terms of this podcast. So, you know, it's been fun to be part of that.
Brilliant. And to then wrap this up, Andre, could you give us a little bit of a take on your perspective on science communication and its importance?
Obviously, I can only agree with my colleagues that preceded me in how important it is. And I also agree that there is a request to our scientists, increasing demand that is coming up from societal stakeholders, be it governments, being international corporations, and so forth, to also bring our insights into the mix. But I would like to make the story a little bit more complex and a little bit maybe take a little bit the innocence out of it. I think there is a bubble still that we are addressing, right? That's the bubble that is interested in what we have to say, that is the well-educated, that say, you know, what does the scientist have to say with that? But I'm also thinking of recently, well, a few months back, when Anthony Fauci gave an interview and somebody shouted out, "Fauci, who made you God?" You know, and that gives you a sense of science becoming just one more opinion amongst many, right? So in the past, I've been addressing the issue how we need as a university, how we need to move on from being a university towards what I call a multiversity. And what I mean with that is that not only do we have to address this question of what Foucault called discipline and punishment, right? Something is right and everything that is not right needs to be punished, needs to be demeaned, and needs to be told how not right it is. This is not the way that we can continue to communicate with society, right? We need to integrate society in the process of research. This is where we move beyond just interdisciplinarity to transdisciplinarity and deal with the questions together with society, right? Develop the questions and address them together. And I'd like to end with a fiction story because I know Anik likes it. Michael Ende's never-ending story, right? Young Balthasar, Bastian Balthasar books, he finds this book in the antiquariat and it's about Fantastica, this magical land. And in his imagination, he goes there and he goes to this ivory tower that is academia. And in this ivory tower lives the childlike princess. And what does this childlike princess tell him? She said, "Nothingness will devour the whole world that we're living on, including this ivory tower, if you don't say my name, if you don't believe in me," right? And this is exactly where we are right now as academics. If society stops believing in us, we are done and we can pack and do some other business. But what we need to do is we need to become relevant again. And we can only become relevant if we start cooperating, and we need to start cooperating on the most local level with high schools, with primary education, and bring people back into this idea that the art and the technique of science and scientific thinking is something that is worth aspiring to.
Wow. Fascinating and just amazing insights from all of you on that question. It's something me and Deepak have talked about continuously throughout the podcast, and we really want to work really hard to make this podcast into an avenue to improve science communication. So I'm really happy with Nicola's comments about our podcast. I appreciate that. We've come to the end. So thanks to all the guests for joining us on this panel. Thanks to Dixon Poon School of Law for hosting this event and been really great supporters of us throughout the year. So really, really grateful for your support. Anyone who's just joined and listened for the last hour and a bit, please make sure you check out the podcast. We really appreciate all the listens and all the support today. We are on Spotify. We are on Apple. We're on probably every platform wherever you could listen to your podcast. And we look forward to your listens. Before we end, I did want to end on a thought as we've been talking a lot about nationalism, how we can improve global cooperation. One thing I did hear recently on another podcast, which is probably very, very relevant, is being empathetic is probably the most patriotic thing we could do in this day and age. So that's all I wanted to say, and see you next time.